obstacles and demands, but that's not relevant.
Every single person I talked to last night blamed the death of these hostages on Netanyahu, saying that they believed he was the one obstructing the ceasefire deal.
So where do things stand with that deal that people are calling for?
It's really hard to know exactly. There are negotiating teams still working through the technical parts of a possible deal. But even just yesterday, Netanyahu dug in, saying that he won't give up Israeli military control of a strip of land between Egypt and Gaza called the Philadelphia Corridor. He said that this is vital to his goal of eliminating Hamas and the militant group's access to the smuggling tunnels there. This has been one of the main sticking points in the deal, and Netanyahu is not budging. Meanwhile, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza in the past few weeks as the ceasefire deal has been in negotiations. So the war is still very much continuing there.
Yeah, and it's about to enter its 12th month. Tens of thousands of people killed, mostly women and children, according to health officials there over that time. What is the situation today?
Well, over the weekend, Israel and Hamas agreed to a very limited pause in fighting in certain areas of Gaza as UN officials, UN health workers began a very ambitious and challenging vaccination campaign against polio. They were able to vaccinate more than 72,000 children yesterday, according to health officials there, which is good, but it's well below the 600,000 goal that they have for this three-day campaign.
That's NPR's Kat Launsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks, Kat.
Thanks, Leila.
Back here in the U.S., Labor Day, the holiday to celebrate American workers, is a moment when labor unions hold parades and picnics to celebrate their role in giving members a voice in the workplace. But in an election year, Labor Day is also about politics. And as NPR's Don Gagne reports, this year labor is playing an especially visible role in the presidential race.
If you're looking for an example of how unions and the election are intertwined, look no further than the United Auto Workers' combative president, Sean Fain.
Kamala Harris is one of us. She's a fighter for the working class. And Donald Trump is a scab.
That was at the recent Democratic National Convention, where a parade of union leaders spoke. Other high-profile speakers also gave labor a shout-out. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez embedded hers in this attack on Trump.
And I, for one, am tired of hearing about how a two-bit union buster thinks of himself as more of a patriot than the woman who fights every single day to lift working people out from under the boots of greed, trampling on our way of life.
Democrats need labor to turn out. Liz Shuler is the president of the AFL-CIO, the nation's largest labor organization. She says in key battleground states, union members make up 20% of the vote. Plus, it's also significant that public support for unions is the highest it's been since the 1960s.
We've had historic highs. The last several years, young people under the age of 30 are the most pro-union. So what does that speak to? It speaks to the fact that the economy has been broken for young people for way too long.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump also sees union support as key, but he doesn't need a majority of voters there. He just needs to shrink the Democrats' traditional lead with labor. That's what helped him carry Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and the presidency in 2016. But 4 years later, Joe Biden won each of those states, in part by restoring Democrats' level of support with unions. Which brings us to this year. Here's Trump at the Republican National Convention.
And the leader of the United Auto Workers should be fired immediately, and every single auto worker, union and non-union, should be voting for Donald Trump. Because
Mike Hinton is a General Motors retiree who talked to NPR as he headed to a Trump rally this summer in Saginaw, Michigan. Personally, he says he ignores his union's candidate endorsements. Here's why this former Democrat backs Trump.
We're a mess overseas. They don't respect us over there. I says our economy is just out of hand for the elderly folks especially. And we need a change, and we need to get them back in there to get things under control again.
Still more common are union members like Raquel Harvey, who was cheering on the Harris-Walls ticket when they held a rally at a UAW local outside Detroit. Harvey says she does want to hear what her union thinks about candidates.
Anybody the UAW endorses, you know, they support the working class, so it has a big effect on, you know, my decisions that I would make when I'm voting.
Unions are also stepping up their social media presence, like this UAW TikTok with audio of Trump joking with Elon Musk about firing workers who strike.
The company, but they go on strike and you say, that's okay, you're all gone.
But even with all the increased social media, AFL-CIO President Liz Shuler says the most important way to reach union voters is still union members talking at work, in the break room, or after hours.
Union members will be the ones who will be at the center of their communities, educating voters, bringing their friends and family and their neighbors and coworkers to the polls. That old-fashioned person-to-person getting people to the polls is what the labor movement's bread and butter is.
The election is 9 weeks from tomorrow. Shuler sees it as a sprint with union activists trying to reach a critical group of voters. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
Thousands of Floridians who have served their time after a felony conviction don't know whether they can get their voting rights back. Advocates have asked state officials for years to create a system to help them get an answer. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports on a new state proposal that those advocates say could be a step in the right direction.
It's been almost 6 years since Florida voters approved a ballot measure restoring voting rights to people with felony convictions. But before that measure, known as Amendment 4, went into effect, Republican lawmakers required that people pay off any fees and fines associated with their sentence. Since then, it's been hard for felons to know if they're eligible to vote or how much they might owe to get their rights back.
It really created a challenge for, we would say, roughly around 700,000. So we do know that there are like hundreds of thousands of folks that just don't know.
That's Desmond Mead with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He says part of the problem is that lawmakers didn't create a system or database for people to look up what they might owe. When asked about this, Florida Secretary of State Cord Byrd told lawmakers last year that returning citizens could always reach out to his office for help.
But there's not a database, and part of the problem is that the clerks of court are the repository of much of the information regarding fines, fees, restitution, because that's really where the difficulty is coming in with the Amendment 4 voters.
Mead's deputy director, Neil Vole, says he's been working with the state for years now to try to fix this.
And so what we've been asking for is clarity in the process and a deadline in which the state would give a yes or no answer to a returning citizen who's trying to seek clarity.
And recently, state election officials announced they have a plan to make this easier. If approved, Floridians would be able to request an opinion from the state, and they'd get an answer within 90 days. Here's advocate Desmond Mead again.
I think this is a big step on the part of the state to help people come to a solid answer on whether or not they're eligible and help them feel comfortable.
This process, though, is unlikely to give folks a solid answer in time for them to register for this year's presidential election, where Floridians will also weigh in on ballot measures related to abortion and legalizing marijuana. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, and thanks for being here. It's 8:19 on this Labor Day Monday. Still to come on the program, as you may or may not know, fall is a huge season for books, especially because it kind of leads right up to the holidays. Well, the NPR team took a look at some of the most anticipated nonfiction titles. They'll be coming out in the next few months. We'll hear that story coming up in just a few minutes before the news at 8:30. On WPR.
Larry is news you can use.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be on your show again as we move inexorably towards spring.
You're wondering how hot this summer is going to be?
You know, everything has been a month early this year.
Well, I think we got warm in February.
We did. This year was just this year was weird across the board, as we all know.
The Larry Miller Show. weekday mornings at 11 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at bolt.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha Public Library is launching a series of programs with community partners that's designed to build foundational communication and language skills for babies and toddlers. For more information, visit mykpl.info.
Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, lots of sunshine expected across Wisconsin today. Pretty pleasant temperature-wise as well, with highs topping out in the low to mid-70s. Wind speeds will start to pick up tomorrow, but nothing to be concerned about, with highs still in the mid to upper 70s. Clouds will start to build throughout the day Wednesday, could bring some rain in the northwestern part of the state. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at USPS.com/advantage. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is enterprise AI. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Are you tired of swiping left and right on the apps? Are you just over it? You're not alone.
That endless swiping is not leading to lasting connections. That's what a survey for a Forbes HealthOne poll found. They say what the apps really are is exhausting.
You're going through this gamification design that's not really ideal for you to find people in a meaningful way.
So people like Sally Hama are working on alternatives. She co-founded a matchmaking service for professional Black women. She says her clients at Carpe Diems are feeling the fatigue.
People feel like there's an infinite number of options out there, but that's not really the reality. And what that's resulted in is what we call a paradox of choice. So having too many choices causes decision paralysis, and that makes us less happy, less satisfied.
That's why her service is pivoting to in-person events like speed dating and relationship workshops.
My advice to singles is always don't limit yourself to a dating app or one form of connection, whether it's in a platonic way or in a romantic way. And so if there is this opportunity through a friendship app to meet people who are, you know, amazing or potentially people who you could form friendships with, I say go for it.
It could be the answer to dealing with what Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says is a health crisis of loneliness.
Research shows that loneliness and isolation are associated with a greater risk of heart disease, dementia, stroke, depression, anxiety, and premature death.
Sally Hama herself signed up for a meetup app called TimeLift that pairs six strangers for a Wednesday night meal.
The first thing you do when you create your account is to fill a personality test. So we ask you some basic question and funny question. Are you like more like a morning person, a night person?
That's Max Barbier, who co-founded TimeLift. And he says those questions can cook up a fun dinner with people you don't know.
We have kind of a recipe, like, you know, three women, three men, the age gap, like a bit of extrovert, a bit of introvert, all this kind of thing to a good dinner.
Now, meeting complete strangers might sound intimidating, but Adrian Wood at the University of Virginia's Emotion and Behavior Lab says it's worth it.
You're probably going to enjoy it yourself more than you think, and you are more interesting in general than you think you are.
Wood suggests put yourself out there.
Go talk to strangers. Go to networking opportunities. Join clubs. Find new people who are maybe slightly different from you to become connected with. Having a greater diversity and a greater number of friends that you're connected to gives you a wealth of resources.
People in cities can be lonely even when there are people all around them, which is why friendship apps like TimeLift are becoming more popular. And then there's what your mom would say, join a club, a hiking club, a running club, go to church or the mosque or the synagogue, and get off your phone.
Labor Day signals the summer coming to an end, which can be a bummer, except for the fact that it also means we have a whole heap of books coming out this fall to look forward to. Andrew Limbong is host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast and has some nonfiction recommendations for us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Layla.
So looking ahead to the next couple months, we've got a few high-profile memoirs coming out, right?
Yeah, I'm particularly stoked on the new Connie Chung book coming out in a few weeks. It's just called Connie. You know, she's a big deal in our field of broadcast journalism.
She can be a one name.
Yeah, yeah, she can get away with it. She was the first woman to co-anchor the CBS Evening News, the first Asian journalist to sit in the anchor chair for a national news broadcast. The book will cover a lot of her career trajectory, you know, those early days at CBS, duking it out with other reporters, dealing with, you know, men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also her marriage to Maury Povich, who is, you know, no slouch in the broadcast department himself. On a similar note, Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson has got her memoir coming out tomorrow. This is titled Lovely One, based on her name. She is, of course, the first Black woman Supreme Court justice, and kind of similar to the Connie Chung memoir, it'll track her come up in a field where not a lot of people look like her. Mm-hmm. And there's one more I want to shout out, actually. Al Pacino has got his book. Yeah, he's got his book coming out. It's titled Sunny Boy. The New Yorker just ran an excerpt of it. And in that section, he's talking a lot about like going to the movies with his mom and growing up with his family, being the only Italians in the neighborhood, and drawing connections between his childhood and like the movies he'd later make.
Okay, what about for the history buffs out there?
All right, Layla, do you have a person in your life who's like really interested in presidential biographies?
Yes, my uncle. It's like all he reads.
Okay, yeah, all right, so shout out to him. For him, there's this new book about Reagan coming out by Max Boot. It's titled Reagan, His Life and Legend. It's a deeply reported book based on a ton of interviews, and it looks at Reagan's childhood, his Hollywood years, and obviously his presidential career. Max Boot, he just published an op-ed in the Washington Post and said that like during the reporting for this book, he found that Reagan was both more ideological and more pragmatic than most people think. So, yeah, it's not like a hagiography, right? It's looking at the entire guy. And so it's definitely for people interested in the presidency, like your uncle.
So Reagan was in office from 81 to 89. I take it something important happened right after.
Yes. Thank you for that setup. Because in February 1989, we got the debut album from De La Soul. Mirror, mirror on the wall. And for all the Gen Xers out there who know all this, bear with me for a second while I explain to the kids that De La was this incredibly influential hip-hop group, you know, pioneering the rap we hear today. And I'm telling you this because in a few months, the music writer Marcus J. Moore is coming out with a book called High and Rising. It's a biography of the band, putting them into the context of the time and why they matter today. I know Moore's writing from a book he wrote about Kendrick Lamar a few years back, and he's really good at explaining the like relationship between music and the culture at large. It's an interesting time for a De La book. I mean, one of their founding members just died last year, and for a long time, their music wasn't available on streaming services just because of like label hijinks and stuff. Mm. But it's up there now, and it's now there for a new generation.
All right, Andrew, giving us a reason to not be so bummed about summer coming to an end. Mm-hmm. Andrew Limbong hosts NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Layla.
This is NPR News.
Writer Edwige Dantika has nostalgia for the Haiti of her childhood before the violence and strife the country is experiencing today. And she says she's not the only one.
I think it's a bit more acute for anybody from a place around the world that's in distress because you're actually living two lives.
Her new essay collection, We're Alone, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. So glad you're with us on this Labor Day Monday for Morning Edition on WPR News. It's 8:29. News from NPR and WPR starts now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A general strike in Israel has been causing disruptions today. The protest was called in response to the killing of six Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Their bodies were found by the Israeli military over the weekend in an underground tunnel in the Rafah area. The families of those killed believe the six would have made it home alive if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had agreed to a ceasefire deal with the militants. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Tel Aviv.
A lot of things are closed. Many schools, government buildings, the airport even closed for a few hours this morning. And a lot of private businesses have closed in solidarity as well. The nation's largest labor union here said that, quote, only a strike will shock, and went on to call for a ceasefire deal immediately. This is the first time this has happened since the war began last October.
An Israeli court is ordering that strike to end. Thousands of hotel workers are on strike in cities across the U.S., including San Francisco, Seattle, and Boston. They're calling for higher pay and expanded benefits. The strike is affecting major hotel chains such as Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu says hotel workers are vital to her city.
Whenever someone comes to visit and they stay in one of these hotels, it is our hotel workers who are putting in the work and the labor to make sure they have a great experience from the very beginning.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. An estimated 82 clean energy projects in Wisconsin may be eligible for incentives from the Inflation Reduction Act. That's according to a new report from the Climate Jobs National Resource Center. It looked at how the law boosts the clean energy sector while also creating union jobs. The projects identified in Wisconsin are either planned, being built, or recently completed. The report says those developments account for an estimated 42,000 jobs and $18 billion of investment. Amy Berrio is with Clean Wisconsin. She says the Inflation Reduction Act has helped speed up the transition away from fossil fuels.
When you look at this 82 clean energy projects in the pipeline, that's a huge deal. That's changing how Wisconsin gets its energy.
The state's major utilities pledged to use union workers for their clean energy build-out. That helps them qualify for tax credits related to good wages and registered apprenticeships. Some farmers in northern Wisconsin have long struggled to deter wolves that attack their livestock. As Daniel Kading reports, state and federal wildlife officials have been installing predator-proof fences on at least half a dozen farms with promising results.
Dustin Soyring says he and his family have long had run-ins with wolves on their farm in Maple. The family had tried non-lethal methods like flashing lights or radios, but they only deterred predators for a while. Last year, state and federal wildlife officials installed a predator-proof fence. It includes a wire apron on the ground that prevents wolves from digging underneath. Soyring says it's been an excellent tool.
This was the first year that we've ever gone through an entire calving season, which all of them were calved inside that predator fence. We didn't lose a single calf to predators.
The farm has been adding another fence this year. They've been installed on six farms in northern Wisconsin. So far, wildlife biologists say they've been 100% effective at deterring wolves. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Former President Donald Trump will return to Wisconsin on Saturday for a rally in the Wausau area. It's the Republican presidential nominee's second visit to the state in a little over a week. On the Democratic side, vice presidential nominee Tim Walz is expected to speak at Laborfest in Milwaukee around 2 o'clock this afternoon. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Voters in two states in eastern Germany have given a far-right party its best result since World War II. The outcome of yesterday's elections have political observers worried about a resurgence of anti-immigrant populist politics in Europe. NPR's Rob Schmitz is with us now from Berlin to talk about this. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, Michelle.
So let's just start with what happened in these two elections yesterday.
Yeah, the elections were held in the German states of Thuringen and Saxony. Both are in the former East, which was for decades under communist rule, and they're both known for being home to extremist politics. But yesterday's results delivered a very big boost to far-right politics in Germany.
So tell us more about that. Tell us about the party that did so well.
Yeah, this party's called the Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD. It's a nationalist party that routinely targets immigrants and blames them for many of Germany's problems. The party's been around for 11 years, and it rose in prominence after former Chancellor Angela Merkel allowed more than a million migrants from war-torn countries in the Middle East to resettle in Germany. The AfD has become so notorious that it's been placed under domestic surveillance for the threat that it poses to the country's constitution. Now, despite all this, the AfD won the most seats in the election in Thuringen with around a third of parliament, and it nearly won the most seats in Saxony with more than 30% of the vote. But it is important to note here that all other parties refuse to govern with the AfD. So the party will likely not be part of either state's government, but it will be a big force in their parliaments, and it'll have a big influence on policymaking regardless.
So you mentioned that these two states are in Germany's former East, and you mentioned that extremist politics have found a home there. So, you know, is this kind of politics particularly resonant to that region, or is this part of a bigger trend that we need to pay attention to?
Yeah, yes and yes. I mean, it's definitely resonant in this region, but it also is part of a bigger trend throughout Germany. I spoke to Suda David-Wilp about this. She's the director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office, and she said the federal government in Berlin may try to brush these results aside.
But Berlin can't ignore these results and claim they're only distinct to the former East, because all the campaign themes that played out in these two state elections are going to stay in the picture during the federal election next year.
And Michelle, you know, Germany will hold a national election in a year, as you just mentioned, and she says that frustration over unchecked migration is going to play a big part. You know, last week, a Syrian man who was supposed to have been deported murdered three people and injured several others at an event in the western German city of Solingen, and that's led to calls for tighter immigration rules. Another concern here in Germany is support for Ukraine. Many Germans, especially those in the former East, have suffered economically from the impact of this war, and due to the region's history, they have a familiarity with Russia, and they're pushing for a diplomatic solution to end this war.
So, Rob, before we let you go, you were telling us that these two states are sort of smaller population, and
right.
So perhaps, you know, not the big sort of population centers that people think of. But what will these results mean, or what could they mean for next year's federal election in Germany?
Yeah, these two states are small, but they're important because of what happened here. And these are really far-right parties. And you know, now that we've got a national election coming up next year, it underscores how popular these parties are becoming. You know, it's clear that in the next election, the country is going to be making a shift to the right. It might not be as dramatic as these two states, but it'll mean stricter immigration rules and a bigger focus on Germany's stagnant economy.
That is NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Deaths in the mining industry last year neared their highest number in a decade. Most occurred in surface mines like strip or open pit mines, which vastly outnumber underground mining operations in the U.S. But Kentucky Public Radio's Justin Hicks learned there are fewer opportunities to train above ground miners to rescue their coworkers.
On a Wednesday morning before the sun crested the horizon, dozens of miners were already hard at work, searching for survivors in a mine accident. They quickly put on specialized oxygen masks that screech when they turn on. This is the National Mine Rescue Contest, held every 2 years. But these miners aren't underground. They're in a downtown convention center in Lexington, Kentucky. Brian Gepfert with the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration watches off to the side. He says they'll throw all sorts of scenarios at these miners to prepare them for, God forbid, the real deal.
There's usually unaccounted people, fires, unstable ground, water. It's a combination of those different things, and kind of almost like a geometry problem. You're looking at how do you solve this.
Now, it requires a bit of imagination to see those hazards. Curtains and poles symbolize rock walls, and paper signs warn of toxic gas. Missouri miner Steve Stetzer knows it's a far cry from a real mine, but he believes it's still helpful to young miners.
The main thing we'd like to do is get teams under duress, get them tired, get them stressed, because that's when they got to make tough decisions. And tough decisions is the big deal of it.
And there have been a lot of those tough decisions lately. Last year, 40 miners died at work.
Last year was not the best year for all the mining community.
That's Chris Williamson, head of the Federal Mine Safety Agency. He says he had lots of meetings with mines and inspectors to stress safety. So far this year, 16 miners have died on the job.
We're over halfway into the year. The number of fatalities have dropped dramatically.
There's still one big problem. The vast majority of deaths this year and last have happened at surface mines, not underground mines. And most competitions and trainings are designed for underground rescues, even though 95% of the nation's mines are above ground. Williamson says historically, there's not been as much energy around surface rescue competitions and training, but that's changing.
On the surface side, you know, more and more people are seeing the value of mine rescue and how important it is to have really good teams.
Right now, the best place for surface mine safety, training, and competition happens in a place without a single mountain, Florida. Karen Miller manages mine safety there.
We have no underground mines in the state of Florida. Everything is surface mining.
Miller organizes the largest surface mine competition in the country, which is still a fraction of the size of underground mine competitions. She says it started because their regional mine safety director asked them to lead the way about 5 years ago.
They were like, we've got to do something for surface. They asked us, would you be interested in putting together a mine rescue surface competition?
Instead of focusing on underground worries like toxic gas, they focus on things like firefighting, first aid, and rescuing people from vehicles. Miller says she's hoping to start the first ever national surface mine competition next year.
Because that's the only way they're going to learn. Because really the first line of defense is the miners. They need to be.
Miller's surface competition has grown to about 20 rescue teams at her biggest competition. Still nowhere close to the more than 70 rescue teams at the underground national competition. But it's a start. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Lexington, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
And this is WPR News. Glad you're with us. Thanks for being here on this Labor Day. Still got about 18 minutes left in the program and a couple of really interesting stories to get to. We're going to hear about the story of a prominent Chinese dissident who actually turned out to be a con artist. That story is still to come this hour. Plus, we'll hear about orchards that were established by Mormon pioneers. Experts say that the heirloom fruit varieties can be insurance against climate change. That's all ahead here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
News, conversations, music, and companionship. Wisconsin Public Radio is an important part of your community. We're committed to being the premier source for trustworthy news in Wisconsin by meeting the highest standards of journalistic integrity. Your philanthropic gift supports this mission and ensures that our state has the best public radio service possible. Make your generous gift now at WPR.org/donate. Thank you.
WPR News is your source for independent journalism, compelling stories, and refreshing entertainment. Thank you to our members who provide the larger source of funding for the WPR programs you value and enjoy every day.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center, promoting quality of life by offering information, support, and options. Our services are free and confidential. For more information, call 262-605-6646.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44. Here's what's happening in news. A general strike in Israel has resulted in widespread disruptions, including at the country's main international airport. This comes after news that six hostages were found dead inside of Gaza. Russia launched an overnight barrage of drones and cruise and ballistic missiles at Kyiv, according to officials there. This as children prepare to return to school after summer vacation. A man has been arrested and charged with the killing of a UW-Whitewater student. Police there responded to an apartment building late Friday night. The university says 21-year-old Kara Welsh from Plainfield, Illinois, was the victim. And Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz is expected to speak at a Labor Day event along Milwaukee's lakefront. It's set to take place around 2 o'clock this afternoon. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Capitol Reef National Park in Utah may be best known for its towering red rock cliffs. The park's historic orchards are also a big attraction. Heirloom fruit varieties like the ones planted by pioneers are more than just fun to look at. They could be climate insurance for the food system. But old trees are dying and new ones are getting harder to find. David Kondos of member station KUER has this report.
Capitol Reef is a mostly unforgiving, rocky desert landscape. But its orchards sit in a lush green valley, a meandering oasis that follows the path of the Fremont River. The park's Shauna Cottrell wades through waist-high grass in the shade of a giant apricot tree.
Yeah, these are them. And they're fuzzy.
This tree, planted by a Mormon pioneer family, is nearly a century old. Today, the park manages roughly 2,000 fruit trees across a dozen species. And last year, visitors picked literal tons of fruit.
Yeah, this is one of the older trees.
But many trees here are nearing the end of their lifespans, and these specific heirloom varieties have become rare. For some, like the park's namesake red apple, these orchards might be their last hope.
If we lose the Capitol Reef red here, it's gone. There are very few places that it exists.
So Capitol Reef is in the middle of a major replanting project, adding around 700 new trees since 2022. But bringing heirloom fruits back from the brink is not easy work. Park staff have to become history detectives, identifying which fruit varieties settlers planted here decades ago. Then they have to find living specimens, if they still exist, and get them to grow here again. And there's an urgent reason to preserve as many heirloom fruits as possible, says Todd Little Siebold, a fruit historian with the College of the Atlantic in Maine. Having more varieties makes our food system less vulnerable to future diseases and climate extremes.
We need apples that are able to tolerate these broad swings, the extremes that we haven't seen, particularly with the threats of climate change. I think we don't know what will grow in the future.
Weather data shows the park's average March temperatures over the past decade are nearly 2 degrees warmer than they were in the 1940s. Park Superintendent Cass Bromley says small changes can add up.
Climate change isn't occurring in a vacuum. It's one more stressor. So if the trees aren't healthy because the climate has shifted a little bit and they're not quite getting what they need, then they're more vulnerable.
One thing they're studying is if the trees are blooming earlier. That could lead to a timing mismatch with pollinators, like this bee along the edge of the orchard. And more intense rainstorms could increase erosion and flooding along the orchard's river corridor. But so far, Capitol Reef's replanting project is showing promise. Shauna Cottrell walks past rows of baby trees, just a few feet tall. Some varieties, like the Lambert cherry, once grew here. Now, it's back.
You want me to try one? Okay. There's a little tarp.
Juicy, though.
Very juicy, very yummy.
In this one orchard alone, park staff have planted more than a dozen types of cherry and apple trees, including some new Capitol Reef reds.
This one's more ripe.
And with more than 1 million people visiting each year, the park hopes this new generation of trees will have plenty of chances to share how important historic varieties are to the future of fruit. For NPR News, I'm David Kondos in Capitol Reef National Park.
This is NPR News.
And this is WPR News. Thanks for being with us. 11 minutes left in the program now on this Labor Day. That story about a Chinese dissident turned con artist coming up in just a few minutes. A special Labor Day episode of our podcast, Wisconsin Today Morning News, is also available today. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back to the daily news on that podcast tomorrow. This is WPR.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, which invites visitors to its lakefront campus in Kenosha on Thursday, September 12th, to learn why Wisconsin could become a climate haven, attracting people and jobs from areas hard hit by climate change. The free luncheon features Susan Crawford, a former special assistant to the Obama administration. She'll lay out the implications for the state's power grid. Register at carthage.edu/climate.
It's Morning Edition on WPR News. In sports, the Milwaukee Brewers fell to the Cincinnati Reds yesterday, 4-3 the final. The Brewers are still in first place in the division, comfortable 9 games up over the Chicago Cubs. The Brewers will take on the St. Louis Cardinals this afternoon in Milwaukee. First pitch is set for 1:10. The Wisconsin Badgers football team got a win over Western Michigan to start the season. They will take on the University of South Dakota in Madison this weekend. The Badgers women's volleyball team falling to the University of Texas last night by a final score of 3-1. And the Green Bay Packers will start the regular season this Friday night in Brazil, taking on the Philadelphia Eagles. That kickoff is set for 7:15. In weather, lots of sunshine expected across the state today and pretty mild temperatures as well. Highs topping out in the low to mid-70s across the state. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This next story is an example of how journalism sometimes works. You go looking for one story, one narrative. And if you keep your mind open and also dig into the facts, you discover the real story is entirely different. NPR Global Democracy correspondent Frank Langfitt was part of a team that investigated how China's government targets dissidents and critics overseas. Then, in one specific case, they discovered something else, something that raised doubts about everything they assumed to be true. Frank is in our studios. Frank, welcome.
Hey, Steve. Great to be here.
Just to start with the overall topic here, I guess we should note China really does target dissidents overseas, right?
Absolutely, Steve, and it's extremely well documented.
And this is something that you would know because you lived in China, you covered China, you've then moved to Europe and other parts of the world, now you're in the United States, and what is the pattern you have seen?
Well, it's like over the years, Steve, I watched China essentially export repression from inside Chinese borders around the world, and this includes, of course, in Europe and in the United States. Chinese government will use everything from online threats and, in a few cases, even abduction. Hmm. And in 2022, there was this new tactic that seemed to emerge that I was intrigued by, calling in bomb threats to embassies and hotels using the names of Chinese dissidents.
Making the dissidents seem like they were responsible for some bomb threat, some crime.
Exactly.
Basically. How did that work?
So somebody would contact a Chinese embassy or hotel, say the dissident had made the bomb threat, and then police might confront them, question them. And it's a form of like what people in America know as swatting, when someone reports a fake crime that tricks police into targeting somebody who didn't do anything wrong.
Okay, so who appeared to have been targeted like this?
Maybe like a half dozen people in Europe and the U.S. The main person is this young, savvy Chinese dissident. His name is Wang Jingyu. He's just 22 years old. He lives in the Netherlands. And Wang said, this experience was really frustrating. And this is what he told me.
I just told some police officer, I said, it's absolutely, you know, made by Chinese authority. And the police asked me, do you need a lawyer? I said, I don't need a lawyer because I didn't do anything.
Why would the Communist Party target this individual?
Well, Wang relentlessly criticizes the Chinese government online. And he also has exposed what he says is the Communist Party attacking dissidents overseas. And these bomb threats, they appeared to be, as far as anybody could tell, payback. And he's, over time, Steve, he's become one of the most public victims of Chinese repression in all of Europe. There have been more than 50 news organizations that have mentioned, quoted, or featured him. And here's just a taste of some of the coverage he's gotten.
Wang Jingyu is heading to his adversary, the Chinese embassy.
Wang Jingyu is a political dissident based in The Hague who claims he has been harassed by people.
And so last year I was talking to Wang and he gave me this tip on a new case. And it was focused on a housemate, a guy that he stayed with in the Netherlands, a guy named Gao Jur.
Mm-hmm.
Gao's also a dissident, a former factory worker. And Gao's family, they were traveling through Thailand trying to get visas to the Netherlands. And they were in touch with Dutch immigration. And then they got this email from an account that identified itself as Dutch immigration. And it said that they'd been accused of making bomb threats to airports in Europe. They were blocked from traveling to Europe. And in the confusion, Gao's wife and daughter, they overstay their visa and they end up in immigration detention.
So it appears here, the outside appearance is that the Chinese government is now targeting these people with fake claims. Why would Gao's family be targeted?
Well, Gao wondered about that as well. And the best he could tell and Wang could tell was this was just a way of getting at Wang through his friend, Gao.
Okay, so these guys believe the Chinese Communist Party is behind the bomb threat. But as journalists, of course, you and your team need to document these things. Was there any evidence?
Yeah, this was a big challenge. Chinese diplomats, Thai police, they wouldn't talk about this case at all. And there was only one official document. This was an email from that Dutch immigration account I mentioned about the bomb threats. But there was no email address. And when we asked Gao for it, he wouldn't give it to us.
That's a little strange.
It was very strange.
Telling you he's a victim? So what did you do next?
I did what anybody would do. Any reporter I called Dutch immigration. First, they wouldn't give me an answer. They cited privacy reasons. And then when I pressed them, they told me the email was a forgery.
So the Netherlands authorities were not manipulated into sending these notes. They're fake. So what was really going on?
What happened was these two men had a big falling out. And Gao told us he thought he'd been conned. And he sent us hundreds of email exchanges with that Dutch immigration account. It turned out it was totally fake. The account actually tricked the family into thinking they'd been implicated in bomb threats, got them to turn over credit cards.
Oh.
And Gao said, Steve, there was one common thread in all of this.
To put it bluntly, Wang Jingyu has been misleading me.
His friend? The
yes.
guy that you knew originally?
The famous celebrity dissident in Europe.
What did you do then?
We flew to Amsterdam to see Wang and confront him, but he didn't show up. So I got him on the phone, and he was actually at a crowded restaurant.
The Gao family thinks that you and other people stole thousands and thousands of dollars from them.
So this is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
And I promise I will sue all of them.
You will sue all of them. Have you ever called in a bomb threat? Ever?
Never.
Have you ever sent an email and made a bomb threat?
This is ridiculous.
Okay, so he denies it, but at least in this case, Wang is accused of scamming a family out of their savings. But didn't you say that this guy has been seen as an authoritative source in news stories about Chinese repression?
Absolutely. And what we're finding now is we're seeing some changes from those news organizations. The Associated Press, which did that story in Thailand, they've retracted it. A German documentary seen by more than 2 million people, that's been taken down as well. And Deutsche Welle, that's Germany's public international broadcaster, they put a note on their coverage saying the Thai bomb threats can no longer be reliably attributed to the Chinese state. And they linked to NPR's story.
I want to emphasize, you're telling me that in this case, it seems not to have been Chinese repression reaching outside the country, but that repression really happens.
Indeed.
And created a climate of fear that made it possible for someone to be conned.
Yeah, and that's where the Communist Party has some responsibility here, because if it didn't do this in the first place, it wouldn't be possible to create a scam, an alleged scam like this.
And people use that fear for their own purposes.
Indeed.
NPR's Frank Langfitt, thanks so much for the insights.
Thanks, Steve.
If you want to read or hear more about this story, go to npr.org and put in the words Chinese imposter. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Alex Crow. That'll do it for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience Wisconsin waterways in fall colors. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or at rutabagashop.com.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started in pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667. This is WGTD HD, 91.1 Kenosha Racine, 101.7 in Elkhorn, and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WPR News from Gateway Technical College.